is at the heart of this company. The structures are created with state-of-the-art irrigation systems. Also, rainwater is collected and distributed to plants. Drainage from the plants is gathered in pools where it undergoes a purification process to remove contaminants, then recycled back into the system. But that's not all. Special ventilation systems control temperature and air circulation. The greenhouses are equipped with shades to control natural light, plus they are fitted with heating and cooling systems. This type of farming comes at a time when the country is witnessing unprecedented heat and water shortages, partially because of outdated agricultural practices.
This type of farming is growing in popularity. The technical term for hydroponic farming is controlled environmental agriculture, or simply indoor farming. These greenhouses create precise growing conditions using technological advances like digital monitoring that draw out the best flavors and textures in produce. And they can be built almost anywhere.
Aside from being a major producer itself, this company offers its hydroponic technology to farmers and growers. Plus, it helps them plant their own greenhouses. It gets its seedlings from its own massive nursery. The seeds are hybrids that are imported. Using hybrid seeds helps grow crops that match international quality, which is beneficial when exporting their produce. This company collaborates with research and academic institutions for agricultural research of cash crops, such as saffron and blueberries. The company stands on the threshold of exporting its produce and welcomes foreign investments to expand its activities. As part of their future vision, they are creating a program for on-site training, which helps users of hydroponic technology in glass greenhouses. Additionally, it is developing lodging and accommodation for national and international agritourists. The most recent addition to their line of work is a packing facility, which packages produce and readies them for market distribution. While the U.S. sanctions do not directly cover the agriculture sector, they have indirectly impacted businesses in this industry. Much of the technology used in this company is imported or has spare parts that need to be imported. The sanctions have hindered international money transfers, making imports and even exports of produce for this company difficult.
As you might know, open lab farming is vulnerable to environmental changes. Droughts, cold spells, heat waves, and soil erosion all impact harvests. The agriculture sector not only plays a big role in managing food security, but also is a big contributor to the Iranian economy. In recent years, water shortages have slowed development in this sector, which has gained the attention of government officials.
The Ministry of Agriculture defined several programs to develop greenhouses to tackle drought conditions. Right now, the total greenhouse area in the country stands at around 21,000 hectares. Government officials want to increase this amount to 25,000 by the end of the year. This will help support plans of the Ministry of Agriculture to transfer vegetable farms to greenhouses. The main objective is to save 10 billion cubic meters of water annually. Many of these greenhouses are set up in agriculture parks inside free trade zones. In fact, in the Northwest, Aras Free Trade Zone opened one of the biggest hydroponic greenhouse complexes in West Asia. The goal is to increase productions for exports. For this reason, agri-parks have a major role in developing technology to support efficient indoor farming. The government provided nearly $200 million worth of funds for creating agricultural parks and greenhouses last year. And this supportive measure has paid off, as over 4 million tons of fruits and vegetables were produced this year from greenhouses. Tehran province is one of the country's biggest producers of greenhouse products. Yazd, West Azerbaijan, Bushehr, and Khorasan provinces also have numerous greenhouses, just to name a few.
Iranian agriculture has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. It was one of the only sectors that was barely impacted by the global coronavirus outbreak. Agriculture is not limited to cultivation and farming alone. It also includes dairy, poultry, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. It is considered a strategic sector where goods are enhanced with added value through processing, promotion, and distribution.
Agriculture makes up 8% of Iran's GDP and employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. Iran's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports last year. That's according to the Ministry of Agriculture. Figures from the ministry show Iran has over 18 million hectares of arable land. And last year, nearly 130 million tons of agro products were produced in farmlands. Iran's agro industry is worth billions. Data from Iran's Customs Administration show the value of the country's agricultural exports rose by around 3% this year. Its figures also reveal Iran exported some 5 million tons of agricultural products worth nearly $3 billion this year. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list was pistachio, selling off roughly $540 million worth of nuts. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture products also generated $1 billion in exports.
All right, everyone, it is time for me to step aside for several minutes as my good friend and colleague is about to take you on another educational adventure. Enjoy.
In a world where our lives are becoming increasingly intertwined with the zeros and ones. We transfer money, we call our friends, and we do our shopping using these two magic numbers that form the foundation of the virtual yet real world that's called IT. Today, I'll walk you around this Iranian company that has a lot to say when it comes to the IT sector.
Here, only the impossible is impossible. The motto, which Ida Bonyan Mobtaker Pars has set its targets on, the Iranian brand develops a range of IT and ICT products, from apps and websites to educational content. The idea of launching such a business was developed more than a decade and a half ago in the mind of its CEO when he was just a high school student.
E-commerce is one of the amazing outcomes of the digital space. The emergence of online shopping has provided an instant link between customers and sellers, where customers can easily window shop and get their hands on their desired items in a tap of a finger.
Minikala is the name of a newbie online shopping app that's developed by the thriving brand. In less than 2 years, the number of Minikala users is rapidly approaching 500,000. Ida Bonyan Mobtaker Pars is an umbrella company that has under its belt a range of startups producing apps with different purposes, from money management apps to shopping and medical applications. This is what makes this firm stand out from the ever-growing number of rivals in Iran.
Digital marketing is a newbie business in Iran, but still, there are many companies, Iranian companies, who have stepped into the realm of the digital marketing or e-commerce. Despite its adverse effect on the global economy, when it comes to digital marketing, the coronavirus pandemic was a blessing, making the online space the safest possible channel for people to get their hands on different products. And this company says it fares even better during the pandemic.
With a dedicated team bringing together more than 150 highly driven programmers, Mobtaker says it tries to expand the scope of its activity based on the needs of the day. Otherwise, it would stay behind in the fast-paced market.
Many thanks for that awesome report. And that wraps up our show for today. Until next time, take care. We'll see you again on another episode of Buzzar.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husayniyah on November 3rd, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance.
The U.S. sometimes, but not always, says that it's willing to cooperate with Iran. Cooperation with Iran isn't compatible with cooperating and helping the accursed Zionist regime. The accursed Zionist regime, with this situation that it has created and the entire world has witnessed, understood, and condemned, is being... The accursed Zionist regime, with this situation that it has created and the entire world has witnessed, understood, and condemned, is being assisted by the U.S. The U.S. is backing it. They're supporting it. Given this situation, cooperation with Iran is meaningless and unacceptable. Yes, if they were to completely stop supporting the Zionist regime, remove their military bases from this area, and stop interfering in the region, these matters could potentially be reviewed. This isn't something foreseeable for now, nor for the near future. What I wish to tell you, dear young people, is the following. First, you must increase your knowledge, familiarity, and awareness of the country's fundamental political issues pertaining to the past, present, and the future. You must truly analyze these circles of knowledge that I mentioned, and analyze our country's past and the events that have taken place. Where have we suffered losses? Where have we achieved gains? Where have we shown weakness? Where have we exhibited strength? And what have the consequences of each of these experiences been?
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In addition, scientific advancements must continue in the country. A few years ago, our momentum in making scientific advancements was very good, but it has slowed down somewhat. I want to tell the officials of our universities, our researchers, and our students that they mustn't allow scientific progress to decline. The rapid speed of this progress is essential for us. The country must move forward in science. The country must also advance militarily, and by God's grace, our military personnel are working diligently day and night. God willing, we will make even further advancements. By God's grace, the country will be able to show that it's a strong nation, and no power, regardless of its capabilities, will be able to force the Iranian nation to surrender or bring it to its knees. Almighty God will help us. Strengthen your connections with God through prayer, the Quran, and by becoming acquainted with the truths of religion. Get help from divine assistance and create a better future for yourselves and for the nation, God willing. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things.
above will always be a shining guide for us to see. And when I doubt, I'll have no doubt, but still I wonder why. Digging through our pages past, wondering how the truth will last. God in control is what I've found. I think I'll try this time around. And no one really feels the path I seek. And no one's gonna care as much as me. And no one seems to know our history. And stories are told for the world to see. And maybe I'll find the path I seek tonight. Let it be. Only God really knows what's right. Maybe I'll find the path I seek tonight. Let it be. Only God really knows I tried.
The heroes of our past unfold. Their glory is unique, we're told. The stories mark a precious past, but do we question why? A quest for truth can never be a lot I've faked inside of me. I walk in shoes I've never felt, only then I'll sure know why. They tell me just make up your mind. The path I seek just needs a sign. The end is where I wanna be. Which way I go is up to me. And no one really feels the path I seek. And no one's gonna care as much as me. And no one seems to know. Seeking, I know you've cared as much as me. Our stories were shared for us to see.
Good night to all our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. And we round up this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The ceasefire between Israel and Gaza faces a critical test. Hamas has rejected any discussion of phase two negotiations as illegitimate, while accusing Israel of breaching the agreement and disregarding its obligations. The controversial Yellow Line declaration is cited as evidence that Israel is not honoring the deal. Hamas insists that before any further talks can proceed, phase one must be fully implemented, a complete cessation of Israeli killings, the opening of humanitarian aid corridors, and the full withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. The fate of the ceasefire now hinges on whether these demands are met or whether mistrust and violations will push both sides back into open conflict. Welcome to Spotlight. I am Bahman Roy. Let us begin with a report.
The U.S.-led peace process for Gaza faces a crisis of credibility. President Trump insists on launching phase two of his plan soon, involving international forces and a new governance council. For him, the phase is already underway, but on the ground, the core commitments of phase one are shattered.
President Trump, can you tell us when phase two of the negotiations will begin?
Well, it started. It started as far as we're concerned. Phase two has started. And, the phases are all a little bit mixed in with each other. They're going to start cleaning up. You look at Gaza, and it's a lot of cleanup.
Israeli occupation forces have declared they are not going to withdraw. They have solidified control over a massive yellow line interior zone, annexing over 55% of Gaza's territory for what Israeli Army Chief of Staff, Erel Zami, calls a new border. Inside this occupied area, home demolitions continue. Outside it, Palestinians are shot. Almost 740 Israeli violations have resulted in the death of nearly 390 Palestinians since the ceasefire began. Hamas has strongly rejected the launching of phase two. Senior official Hussam Badran says any talk of phase two is illegitimate while Israel continues to breach the agreement and disregards its obligations. Hamas condemned the Yellow Line declaration as proof that the regime does not honor the deal. The resistance movement demands full implementation of phase one, including a complete stop to killings, open aid corridors, and Israeli occupation forces withdrawal before any new discussions. For Palestinians, phase one's humanitarian, political, and military promises remain unfulfilled. Would Israeli forces pull out of Gaza as required by phase one, or would they continue to violate the truce by killing more Palestinians in Gaza and keeping their land under occupation?
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Reza Vedadi, academic researcher and author, joining us from London. And Mick Napier, co-founder of a Scottish-Palestine solidarity campaign, joining us from Glasgow. Gentlemen, very good to have you on the program. I'm going to start with Mick right now. Well, why does Hamas consider phase two negotiations illegitimate at this stage?
Because everything that Israel committed to do on paper under pressure from Mr. Trump, they violated. And you can see that in the detail today and over the last couple of weeks. But more importantly, you can see it in the entire history of the Zionist project. And if you think about it, if there's a conflict between two sides, Cambodia and Thailand or other, Ukraine, Russia, and so on, a negotiated settlement is possible. In fact, it usually happens after a war. But that's not the situation for the Palestinians. The Zionist project doesn't involve the idea of negotiating with Palestinians because they are slated for disappearance. You don't negotiate with people whom, at the end of the day, you will simply expel. And so anything that Israel commits to paper is only a holding operation until the next offensive. And that's what we've seen in Gaza. It's no surprise to anyone who looks at the entire history. If you look at the Oslo Agreement, Israel violated the terms of the Oslo Agreement from the very start. So that's what we're looking at. It's shocking, but not remotely surprising to anyone who's looked at Israeli history. And in a sense, the Israelis can't possibly treat the Palestinians as equals. If even Netanyahu, in a parallel universe, decided to do that, behind him, the Zionist project, the genocidal state over 70 years, has created Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and so on, and they would simply bring the government down. So the commitment to ongoing ethnic cleansing, up till the present day, the yellow line, Israel decides to hold on to it rather than vacate, this doesn't come as a surprise to anyone.
Right, Reza, I want to talk to you about the other side of this deal. The Israelis are pressuring and insisting on moving forward despite not fulfilling any part of the phase one completely. How can that be justified, this demand?
It can't be justified. The whole operation of this peace or ceasefire that is not really a ceasefire. I mean, look, Israel has a habit of going around in the region signing up to ceasefires but not then agreeing to it and breaking them. We know that in south of Lebanon, since they apparently came to ceasefire with Hezbollah, they've broken it 1,000 times, either through military incursions by air or by land. And since the ceasefire in Palestine, in Gaza, they've broken it nearly 1,000 times. They've bombed women, men, children, tents. They haven't allowed tents to come in. So their plan is to starve and kill the Palestinians. They show the facade, and that whole Donald Trump peace summit that invited Indonesian prime minister, president, and heads of other states was just for show. It was just an illusion, a control of the narrative to make the people around the world think there is some kind of a peace. But in reality, it was the slow genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza.
Right. I want to focus on the accusations of breach by the Israeli forces. Now, Mick, what specific obligations does Hamas claim Israel has disregarded?
I'm not sure of the detail of this, but one of them was to withdraw. And now we hear the head of the military saying that they will entrench themselves behind on the yellow line and not give up an inch of it. As your other guest says, there's a long history of Israel showing that for them to sign a deal means absolutely nothing when the balance of power shifts in their direction. So there are other commitments as well to release Palestinian prisoners and so on. But Israel can never be trusted to follow any of those. And the statement from the head of the military that they are going to see the yellow line as a new border is not just a violation of what was signed. It's so obvious, it's undeniable. It cannot be seen as anything else by any sensible person. But that's what Israel is doing. For them, it's always been that might equals right. That if they have the power to do something, to violate, to assault, to attack, to dispossess, they will do so in their own, you know, in their own time. They're very alert to international pressure, real pressure. And if that were to come from America, then they would desist. But they think they've got a green light from Trump at the moment, and they think that they can do this, and that's why they've done it. So the Hamas complaint is absolutely valid. It's valid 100 times over. But language is the language that we use in this program. Words mean what they mean. Ceasefire means ceasefire. You stop killing. But in the Israeli parlance, ceasefire means continue the killing in a particular way, and you'll get away with it. And violation of the agreement, they will never accept that they violated the agreement. But for them, Golda Meir and Ben Gurion from the very beginning said that, you know, the only constraint on the expansion of Israel was the balance of power at a particular moment. And that what they said, Jews, right, i.e. Zionist Jews, will occupy whatever they want, when they want. That's what we are seeing now in real time.
Indeed. Well, Reza, Mick just pointed out the fact that the Yellow Line Declaration was a huge bridge. How significant do you believe this declaration is as a proof of Israel's non-compliance with the ceasefire?
I mean, Israel doesn't need evidence to prove that it's non-compliance with any ceasefire. But in this case, the fact that they are occupying an occupied land, so in the sense that Gaza itself was previously occupied, they withdrew from it, and now they're occupying it again, and they're using this occupation as a method to cleanse the area that they've occupied, which is called the Yellow Area, and push the remaining Palestinians into the area which is not fertile. The land, the Yellow Area that they are occupying, is the most fertile part of Gaza, and they're trying to starve the Palestinians slowly, or kill them, or shoot them, or have them put onto flights, taken away to different parts of the world, or pushed into Egypt, or whatever they can. So for them, the process, the aim is to cleanse that area of Palestinians, the processes change. Before, it was a year or two of complete bombing and snipering and killing and burying alive people, Palestinians. Now it's on a slower pace. It's like as if someone's cooking something. Instead of trying to get it done quickly in the microwave, they put it on a slow cook. So the Israelis have, and the only pressure that they understand is the pressure of force. And without America's support and European support, it's very difficult for them to realize, for any country to put pressure on them to abide by any ceasefire.
Right, Mick, the most obvious result of any ceasefire must be, of course, a cease of fire. And a cessation of killings is something the least that any party needs to be able to count on. But what should Hamas do right now? Should Hamas be looking for a ceasefire within a ceasefire? You know, doesn't this make the entire deal so ridiculous?
Hamas are in a very difficult situation. The Israelis certainly started the spike in genocide 2 years ago by saying that they would drive Hamas out of the whole of Gaza. Hamas would be obliterated and destroyed. That hasn't happened. But the overwhelming power, the 2,000-pound bombs that Israel can drop on Gaza, the equivalent of all the atom bombs of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and more, means that Hamas has suffered terribly. Now, every colonial struggle, anti-colonial struggle, the people fighting suffer terribly. But in this occasion, it's really almost without precedent in the history of the human race. So Hamas is in a very, very difficult situation. They don't have allies in many of the Arab countries across the region. They're in Trump's pocket, and some of them are working with Israel under the table. So they're very vulnerable. The only hope that Hamas have, I mean, their courage, their determination. I'm saying things which in Britain will get me arrested, but who cares? The courage and heroism of the Palestinian resistance, specifically of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, is almost without equal in human history as well. But they are now alone. The Hezbollah has been weakened in Lebanon. They're still fighting. Israel hasn't won the fight, but they have weakened the opposition. So they don't have a lot of choices. I think they have to accept some kind of ceasefire. But really, they have to hold on until a wave of resistance comes to their support. And that means across the region and across the whole world, including America, Britain, Europe, and so on. Our own government is jailing thousands of people or charging thousands of people with terrorism for trying to support the Palestinians. It's a fight now between worldwide public opinion, which can it be channeled in time, and the disappearance of the Palestinians, abandoned by the collective West and by many of these Arab regimes. They don't have a lot of options.
Right, Reza. The other demand from phase one was, of course, the opening of the crossings. Even I think it was yesterday or the day before that the Israelis said, we are willing to open the Rafah crossing only for the Palestinians to exit the territory with no return. So, you know, how could this happen under a ceasefire? What are the mediators doing right now?
Well, this just supports my argument that this is a slow ethnic cleansing compared to the faster ethnic cleansing before the ceasefire. And my colleague in Scotland, he just demonstrated that the fact that you are not able to condemn the genociders and praise or support those resisting genocide in a free democratic country explains why they're able to close the Rafah border, why they're able to kill people, innocent people, fear of justice. You have a prime minister, for goodness sake, who has a court order against him that needs to be brought to the International Court of Justice, and he's going around the world and doing what he wants. I mean, when you have some that situation like that, they can do whatever they're literally doing whatever they want. They close the Rafah border, they'll kill anyone that goes into the sea, into the Mediterranean from the Gaza, bury people alive. They don't allow journalists in. They're the third, three years in a row now, the most killers of journalists is Israel. But no one's talking about this in Western media. the narrative doesn't come out. No one in Western legacy media discusses it. We have to discuss it on Press TV. We have to discuss it maybe on RT or the podcasts, which are resisting the legacy media. So the fact that the politics and the media support the ethnic cleansing, they're able to get away with closing the Rafah border and other crimes, war crimes.
Well, of course, make the human situation is indeed grave in Gaza right now, all over Palestine. Do you believe that now humanitarian guarantees should be prioritized over political negotiations in any future negotiation?
I think in Gaza and Palestine, and really in any consideration, humanitarian and political considerations are inseparable, because the only way that humanitarian aid will reach the violated people of Gaza is by a political pressure coming through Western governments, from public opinion, and also Arab populations as well, to make their feelings known, to demand that humanitarian aid be allowed through. There's no doubt at all that if the pressure is great enough, the aid will go through. But it's a political issue, and it can only be resolved in the short term politically and in the long term politically as well. Look, Gaza, I read a few months ago, Gaza has the highest rate of child amputees, not just in war, but in human history. The gravity of the situation defies our ability to find the language to describe it, but facts like that help. The merciless barbarism of the Israelis filming their own crimes is a level of impunity that we didn't even see in Vietnam or Algeria or anywhere else. So the impunity stems from the fact that Western governments ally actively with Israel and against any notion of Palestinian freedom and justice and human rights. I mean, we've never seen an example. We've seen terrible crimes committed by the collective West for the last 500 years, genocide after genocide, huge genocides, bigger than the current one. What we haven't seen is this happening in the public view, and Western governments, knowing that public opinion is opposed to this, nonetheless pushing the sale of arms and diplomatic protection to Netanyahu and the genocidal state. That impunity comes down to grassroots level in the Israeli army, and that's why they feel able to film themselves committing these terrible crimes. So if you think about it, one other thing, the late unlamented humanitarian foundation, which the Americans and the Israelis forced, that was run by a substantial part by a motorcycle gang. Really, motorcycle gang members were recruited in America at a very high daily rate and sent to snipe Palestinians queuing up for food and bread. That level of impunity is what needs to be tackled, and it's a fight between not just the heroic resistance of Palestine against the Zionist project, but all around the world it's a fight between public opinion and pro-Israeli governments.
Right, Reza, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the role of the US here. The US, of course, played a lot of publicity and propaganda over the peace deal with the Cairo summit and everything. And at the same time, now President Trump seems to be a little detached from reality when commenting on the situation here, always talking of a wonderful peace that is holding in Gaza. And what is the responsibility of the US right now in all of this?
Well, the United States is led by a president who has the attention of a five-year-old. It was at that time it suited him to show that he's brought this peace for the Palestinians. And then once he got what he wanted, the media narrative spin on it, he's moved on to something else. He's focused on Venezuela. Now he's trying to bring some kind of a peace in between Ukraine and Russia. And he jumps to different things. There's no doubt that this President Trump has been the most supportive of the genocidal attempts by Israel. And there's no doubt that, as Ayatollah Khamenei has said many times, that Israel is not a state like normal other states. It's a colonial outpost for the United States and the European. When you look at the ethnic makeup of these Israelis that live there, majority of them come from Europe, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and the United States, and countries like this. So America, it's part of the American policy to support Israel as much as possible. And that's why it's going to be very difficult to get peace. However, I do want to make a point that my colleague Mick raised in Scotland. If the Arabs and the countries around Israel, Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and these other countries stop supporting directly and indirectly Israel, it would make the task of the resistance much easier to defend themselves.
Right, and one final question, Mick. Of course, as you said, the situation is very precarious right now. Do you believe external mediators can now bridge the gap between Hamas's demands and the Israeli stance?
That doesn't depend on what's written on paper, because if that were to be enforced, then the Hamas minimal positions would be met, and they would have the possibility of a stable ceasefire. What needs to be done in order to bridge the gap is pressure needs to be put on Israel. If Trump picked up the phone and said, I want my Nobel Peace Prize, I demand that you commit to X, Y, and Z, it would happen. Netanyahu could not possibly stand against Trump. We saw that a few months ago when he didn't want his Nobel Peace Prize. And when Netanyahu went to Washington and sat beside Donald Trump, I watched that scene and I thought, really, he should have been sitting on Donald Trump's knee, because it was quite clear what the power relationship was between the two. And that's still the case. If America or even Europe decided to vigorously challenge Israel, then a real ceasefire could be achieved. But at the moment, all that Netanyahu sees is a bright green light to carry on with everything that he's been doing for 2 years. I mean, we have to remind ourselves what he's been doing for 2 years. It's unspeakable. And that tells us all we need to know about the current situation. Pressure needs to be, the threat of sanctions from the governments need to be raised against Israel in order for them to be brought to heel. They're an attack dog for the West, and an attack dog sometimes bites its master, but ultimately the master has the power if they choose to use it.
It was indeed a pleasure to talk to you, gentlemen, and I wish I could continue the conversation with you for longer, but for the timing purposes, we have to end this right now. Reza Vedari, academic researcher and author, joining us from London, and Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, joining us from Glasgow. And one final comment, the truth will always come out. Whether you stand with it or not is what really matters. I am Bahman Roy.
Muscle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
That was the week that was. Beyond the headlines, we dissect the stories that shaped the past 7 days, from the heart of region to the global stage. In In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to our political chat show, That Was the Week, That Was. We look at global politics and issues of the day, and I'm your host, Leila Garcia. With me here in the studio is veteran journalist and political commentator, Miranda Akhshand. Please stay tuned. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much indeed.
Today's discussion is about Donald Trump's eldest son saying his father may walk away from the Ukrainian war and end America's support for Ukraine, as well as the latest efforts to end the war between Russia and Ukraine. Donald Trump's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., has said his father may walk away from the Ukrainian war. He was speaking at a Middle East conference in Doha, Qatar on Sunday, 7 December. In a lengthy tirade against the purpose of continued fighting in Ukraine, Donald Trump Jr. also said Ukraine's corrupt rich had fled their country, leaving what they believed to be the peasant class to fight the war. Trump Jr. has no formal role inside his father's administration, but is a key figure in the Make America Great Again movement. His intervention reflects the antipathy among some inside the Trump team towards the Ukrainian government, and comes as Trump's negotiating team is putting pressure on Kiev to give up territory. Trump Jr. said the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was prolonging the war because he knew he would never win an election if it ended. He also railed at the EU's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, saying European sanctions were not working since they had simply increased the price of oil, from which Russia could pay for its war. He described the European plan as we are going to wait for Russia to go bankrupt. That is not a plan. Asked if it was possible his father, who ran for election claiming he could bring peace to Ukraine, would simply walk away, Trump Jr. said maybe he would, adding that his father is one of the most unpredictable people in politics. He vowed that the U.S. was no longer going to be the idiot with the checkbook. Okay, let's bring in veteran journalist and political commentator Miranda Akhshand.
Thanks for inviting me.
My first question is, Donald Trump Jr. said Ukraine's corrupt rich had fled their country, leaving what they believed to be the peasant class to fight the war. Tell us more about that.
Yes, he was speaking in this conference in Doha, Qatar, and he said, without providing any evidence, he said he had observed last summer in a single day in Monaco that 50% of supercars, such as Bugattis and Ferraris, had Ukrainian number plates. And he asked, do you think that was earned in Ukraine? And he said, we hear all the rumors about what is going on, and we see every license plate in Monaco is Ukrainian. Right. The rich fled their country, and they left what they believed to be the peasant class to fight the war. Mm-hmm. There was no incentive to stop, because as long as the money train was coming and they were stealing, no one was auditing anything, so there was no reason to come to peace.
I see.
So that was his reasoning for suggesting that the rich had fled Ukraine and the poor were now fighting the war. Now, Trump's eldest son also argued that Ukraine was far more corrupt than Russia. In actual fact, there have been a number of corruption scandals recently that have weakened and damaged the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky in particular. His powerful chief of staff was forced to resign because of a corruption scandal.
Trump Jr. has no formal role inside his father's administration, but he's close to his father. How seriously should we take his comments?
Yes, I think we should take his words seriously because he is close to his father. Donald Trump Jr., as you said, has no formal role in his father's administration, but he is one of the main figures in the Make America Great Again movement, the MAGA movement.
Right.
And basically, what Trump said reflects the fact that there are some within the Trump team are against the Ukrainian government in Ukraine. And Trump's negotiating team is putting pressure on Kiev to give up territory and to accept the Trump peace plan.
Right.
Trump Jr. said the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, was prolonging the war because he knew he would never win an election if the war ended.
Right.
And I think we should take Donald Trump Jr.'s words seriously because he is close to his father.
Yeah.
And there are other indications that Trump's patience with Volodymyr Zelensky and other members of the Ukrainian government is running thin. Donald Trump had threatened in the past that if he felt the Ukrainians were dragging their feet or were disinterested in peace, he would simply walk away and cut off Ukraine's support and let the Ukrainians fight it out with the Russians. So he said that on other occasions in the past. So I think we should take the words of Donald Trump Jr. seriously.
Right. Trump has said Volodymyr Zelensky isn't ready to sign off on a U.S.-authored peace proposal aimed at ending the war between Russia and Ukraine. What is the latest on that?
Yes, the latest is that Donald Trump has said Zelensky isn't ready to sign off on his peace proposal, and there have been 3 days of negotiations between a Ukrainian delegation and the Trump administration in Florida, in Mar-a-Lago, Florida. Trump said, "I'm a little bit disappointed that President Zelensky hasn't yet read the proposal. That was as of a few hours ago. His people loved it," he said, "but he hasn't read it." Now, days of negotiations between U.S. and Ukrainian officials ended in Florida on Saturday. And Zelensky, of course, met with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, and Germany's chancellor, Friedrich Merz, on Monday, 8th of December, and Starmer has repeatedly stressed that Ukraine must determine its own future and said a European peacekeeping force would play a vital role in guaranteeing Ukraine's security. But the fact that Donald Trump, of course, tried to bring peace to Gaza, and the U.S. is now working to push through a peace plan between Ukraine and Russia, U.S. officials claim that they're in the final stages of reaching an agreement between Ukraine and Russia, but there is little sign that either the Ukrainians or the Russians are willing to sign up to Donald Trump's peace plan.
Right.
Trump has said, "Russia is, I believe, fine with the peace deal, but I'm not sure that Zelensky is fine with it.
Yeah.
His people love it, but Zelensky isn't ready." Well, as far as I can say, Trump has had a hot and cold relationship with Zelensky, on-again, off-again relationship with Volodymyr Zelensky, and has repeatedly urged the Ukrainians to cede land to Russia in order to bring the conflict to an end.
Right.
And Trump has said this conflict has, this war has already cost far too many lives. Now, Zelensky said last Saturday that he had a substantive phone call with his officials in Florida who were negotiating with the Trump administration. He said he had been given an update over the phone by both U.S. and Ukrainian officials in, who were involved in the peace talks in Florida. So that's the latest on that.
I see. In its new national security strategy published overnight on Saturday, the White House said it was committed to Ukraine's survival as a viable state. But the strategy also prioritized improving relations with Moscow. Tell us more about that.
Yes, the U.S. national security strategy has alarmed European leaders, but it has been welcomed by Russia. For example, Dmitry Peskov, Kremlin spokesman, said the new U.S. national security strategy spells out the Trump administration's core foreign policy interests, and it was largely in line with Moscow's vision, he said.
Right.
The document released by the White House said that U.S. wanted to improve its relations with Russia after years of Moscow being treated as effectively a pariah state, and the U.S. also wants to end the war between Russia and Ukraine, and this was a core U.S. interest, it said, to end the war, to reestablish strategic stability with Russia.
Right.
This new U.S. national security strategy, this new document also said that NATO must not be a perpetually expanding alliance. And this is another point that the Russians have been complaining about, that NATO keeps continually expanding. So it also made a point about migration and free speech in Europe, suggesting that the Europeans face the prospect of civilizational erasure because of migration to Europe. Now, the Europeans have been rather annoyed by that suggestion. They're saying that this is direct interference in European affairs by the Trump administration, so the Europeans haven't taken kindly to that.
Mm-hmm.
And we can say that despite efforts by Donald Trump and his team to push through a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine, so far it seems that we're still some way off from actually signing a peace deal.
Right. Listening to the Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran, English Radio. This program entitled, That Was the Week That Was. Russia has welcomed the Trump administration's new national security strategy. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said the updated strategic document, which spells out the administration's core foreign policy interests, was largely in line with Moscow's vision. Can you expand that for us?
Yes, Peskov actually praised Donald Trump's latest national security strategy, calling it encouraging. It's an encouraging change of policy in Washington that largely aligns with Moscow's thinking. So this document was published or released on Saturday, and it criticizes the European Union, saying Europe is at risk of civilizational erasure. And it says that the United States is keen to establish better relations with Russia.
Right.
So as Peskov said, the Trump administration was in favor of dialogue and building good relations with Moscow. But Peskov also warned that the U.S. deep state could try to sabotage Donald Trump's vision, which was spelled out in this new national security strategy.
Yeah. What about Europe? What is the European position on Donald Trump's peace plan for Russia and Ukraine?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Europeans are generally skeptical and rather wary of Donald Trump's peace plan for Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
European leaders want to show their solidarity with Ukraine as the White House pressures Kiev to accept a peace deal with Russia. For example, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer insisted that he won't be putting pressure on Volodymyr Zelensky to accept a peace settlement, unlike the Americans. And the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz expressed skepticism about Donald Trump's peace proposal.
I see.
And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has previously called on his European allies for support at times when the White House has tried to push Ukraine towards agreeing to give up territory.
Mm-hmm.
So a key issue for Kiev is what security guarantees it would receive if it does agree to renounce control over some territory, particularly in the east of the country.
Mm-hmm.
It is not clear that either the United States or Europe are willing to offer the kind of security guarantees that would genuinely deter Russia from attacking Ukraine. And we can also say that U.S. officials have claimed to be close to a sustainable peace deal between Russia and Ukraine on a number of occasions in the past, and particularly since Donald Trump began his second term in office. But all these occasions, it turned out that this was just wishful thinking on the part of Trump administration officials. The Europeans generally view peace in Ukraine as being a distant prospect. That's how they really view it, as a distant prospect, and they think quite a lot of work needs to be done before we actually get to peace in Ukraine. Now, Donald Trump's outgoing Ukraine envoy, Keith Kellogg, said at a Middle East defense forum on Saturday that the Trump administration's efforts to end the war in Ukraine were in their last 10 meters, he said. And according to Keith Kellogg, Donald Trump's Ukraine envoy, there were two outstanding issues in the peace talks. One was about territory, the territory which the Russians had captured in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And the other was the fate of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. So those two issues were still unresolved.
Right. To sum up very briefly then, the comments by Donald Trump's eldest son should be taken seriously since he is close to his father. And Trump himself had indicated in the past that his patience was running thin with the Ukrainians because they were dragging their feet or wasting time, and they didn't seem to be interested in peace. Thank you, Mr. Rashonda, for your insightful analysis.